you're around this teaching and this practice for long enough, you will inevitably come across this phrase to see things as they actually are. This encouragement to see things as they actually are, or to live in accord with the way things actually are. And I think when we hear this, it can often sound like a kind of statement of ideology. You know, there's a certain ideology and you're supposed to see things through that lens. And sometimes it kind of puzzles us too, because we generally go through life pretty confident that we are seeing things as they actually are, according to us. According to us. It may not be the way anybody else sees it, but we're seeing things the way they actually are. And I think it's very important to unpack this phrase, to see things as they actually are, because in the context of this teaching, it actually refers to what this weekend is meant to be all about, which is actually deeply understanding these three universal characteristics, or these three universal marks of existence, of change, impermanence, of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness, and of non-self. So to see things actually are, the way they actually are, is really meant to be an invitation to investigate. You know, the Buddha always stressed, you know, don't take things just by belief, or because somebody tells you, or because 1,000 books say it's so. You know, he always stressed, look at it in your own experience and see if this is true. And see if this is true. And this morning I mentioned that different dimensions of insight, the personal insight, the personal story, and what I would think of as being the universal story. And I think these three marks of existence are really referring to this universal story. And in a way, they are so helpful to also apply to our personal story, simply because we tend to take our personal story so personally. And if we could begin to look and hold our personal narrative and our personal story in the light of change, in the light of an unsatisfactoriness which is nobody's fault, in the light of non-self, then it might actually be very helpful in terms of beginning to take it all less personally. So the first of these characteristics or marks of existence, as they're often referred to, first of these universal themes, is the theme of anicca or impermanence. The Buddha once said that just as the elephant's footprint in the jungle is the greatest of all the animals' footprints, the understanding of change is the most transforming of all insights. It really never surprises me that anicca or impermanence is placed as the first of these universal laws, because in many ways, it's the one that we can most readily, at least intellectually, agree with. I doubt that there's anybody here in this room who would put forward the theory that nothing changes and that everything stays the same and that we can find permanence. You know, intellectually, we're actually good at this, you know. In fact, most of you here could probably come up and give a long and detailed discourse on impermanence. And yet, it's also the place where we probably find there's the greatest dissonance between our conceptual understanding and our embodied experience. Would you agree with that? Would you actually find that to be so? We know it. We could have long philosophical conversations about impermanence. All of our life has been teaching us about change. There's nothing in this life that we can count on to stay the same. I think what often the place that is more sticky is to ask ourselves what it means to really live in the light of what we know. To live in the light of what we know to be true and understand to be true. What does it mean to live in the light of understanding impermanence? And what would be the implications of that understanding right now where we are in our lives? I often think this statement of living in the light of what we know or living in the light of understanding the three characteristics, in a way is a step towards putting down our arguments with the unarguables. If we accept or can accept that change, impermanence, is an unarguable reality, where do we argue with it? And what difference would it make in our lives to actually put down that argument? Think of the implications of understanding impermanence deeply. It does make something of a mockery out of clinging and grasping, doesn't it? I mean, it doesn't really make any sense, does it, to try and make something stand still for us when we know its innate nature is to change. It doesn't actually make a lot of sense to cling to something, to grasp hold of something and call it mine and want it to stay here forever when we actually know this is already in a process of changing. I think when we consider what our response is to not understanding impermanence, I think our response is to go through life desperately trying to cling to things in order to make them remain or make them stay the same for us. If we think what our response to understanding impermanence deeply, I think it is to be able to move through this life without that clinging and without that grasping. And, you know, I think it's a real question to ask of ourselves, you know, what at this moment in our life do we cling to most deeply? Do we grasp hold of most deeply? A view, a sense of self, another person, to some situation we want to remain unchanging? To ask ourselves what it is that we cling to most deeply. And to ask of ourselves, what is that emotional climate? Where does that place us? What is the affective tone of clinging and grasping? Is it a place of happiness? Is it a place of well-being? Is it a place of peacefulness? Or is it a place of fearfulness? And a place of anxiety, and a place sometimes of just the stress of trying to hold on to things. When the Dalai Lama taught about impermanence, he would often encourage people to reflect in their life on what has already disappeared. Isn't there a lot? Isn't there a lot that's already disappeared? People who've been deeply part of our lives and who are no longer there. Identities that we thought would last forever. Do you know that one? Have you ever looked through the family photo albums? You know, and seen yourself as this kind of person or that kind of person, you know. And you were sure that was how you were going to be forever. Think about all the thoughts we've had in this life that have already disappeared. Think of some of the passions that have captured us that we thought we would treasure forever that have now changed into something else. Think of the people that we've lost. Think of the emotions that so enthralled us at different times that are really no longer part of our life. And we could even extend that reflection and to think about what is disappearing right now in our lives. What certainties, what securities, how are they disappearing just now in our lives? What ground have we stood upon that is already crumbling? And it seems that everything that comes into being in this life, if we see through those eyes, it's like everything has a message on it that says, you know, to try to take hold of me is to make yourself suffer. To try to take hold of me is to make yourself distressed. So we look at this word, you know, these words, clinging, grasping, they're not just words, they're very visceral experiences, aren't they? They're very emotional experiences. You can feel it in your body, you can feel it in your mind when that impulse of clinging or grasping takes over, the tightening, the contractedness, the defensiveness, or sometimes even the aggressiveness to keep hold of something, you know, to keep hold of something. It's a very felt experience. And in terms of Buddhist psychology, clinging is no more than an intensification of craving and aversion. You know, I remember years ago going, I was in a supermarket and there was a mother walking parallel aisles to me with a young child. And I was listening to this child and it started out by, "Mommy, Mommy, I really like that. Mommy, Mommy, I really want that. Mommy, Mommy, I really need that." And then the tears began. You know, the sense that if I don't have this, I will be so bereft. And that my whole happiness depends upon being able to get this. And craving and aversion are the kind of starting points of this contracting process. And clinging and grasping is no more than a solidification, an intensification of craving and aversion. And perhaps we can spot that in our lives. "I really don't like this. No, I really hate this. No, I really can't bear this. No, I am really, really upset." It's interesting to trace that momentum, that movement. And that move, the very movement in itself, of course, is a denial of impermanence. It's a simple denial of what intellectually, conceptually, we know to be a truth. We are actually pushing against that truth and we get ourselves into trouble. I think we actually really have to see what the implications of that understanding is. Certainly the implications are not indifference. Understanding impermanence is not a prescription to not care or to abandon or to be irresponsible or to not take care of our lives. You know, I've seen that shadow side too often. You know, everything's changing so it doesn't matter. Of course it matters. Of course everything matters. But is there a way of responding to this changing world without those extra ingredients of craving and aversion and clinging? Because in that process, in that momentum, we also see that these are the building blocks of self-view, aren't they, of self-identity. I need, I want, I must have, I am. I don't want, I can't bear. How do I get away from this? I am. It's really important that we begin to trace that movement in our life and to ask ourselves, what does it mean to to live with this awareness of change in such a way that it permeates all of our relationships, all of our ways of seeing, our way of holding the moment. I mean, it allows for so much more spaciousness. It doesn't mean there's no sadness. It doesn't mean there's no sadness over loss, no sadness over separations. But we know that this is true. This is true. This is what life teaches us. This is what life is asking us to learn. Suzuki Roshi, he once said, you know, understanding impermanence is not to deny the things of this world, but to accept that they pass away. Mm-hmm. But to accept that they pass away. Mm-hmm. Every moment we see that, you know, and there's ways of practicing where we can bring that contemplation of impermanence into our practice, really as an intention. You know, where we see the arising and the passing away of a breath, the arising, the passing away of a sound, the arising and the passing away of a thought, the arising and the passing away of a sensation. And in doing so, we're beginning to cultivate the building blocks that allow us perhaps to approach our lives with just that little bit more spaciousness, without the demand that anything stands still for us. In the midst of distress, we know that this too will change. This too is already in a process of changing. You know, I think the reflection upon impermanence does move us more into process mode. Because when we think of our lives, you know, they're like this river of events and experiences, and one breath following another, and one thought following another, a person coming into our lives, a person leaving our lives. It's like this great river of events and experiences that we don't actually control much of the time. And what happens with clinging and grasping is that there's an endeavor to make that river stop, to freeze frame some aspect of it, to make it stand still for us. And in the doing of that, of course, what happens is contractedness. If we can step back and really can have a sense of that river of phenomena moving through every moment, there's a possibility of an enormous amount of appreciation, enormous amount of sensitivity, but there is no demand that life somehow fits into my vision of how it must stay still or how it must change. In that river of events and experience, things are already in a process of changing. But with clinging and grasping, what we do is that we turn that process into a thing, into a state, into a me, into a you, into a you. And it is at a service to us. It undercuts our capacity really to live in harmony, to live in peace with the way things are. So in our formal practice, we can build the foundations, the building blocks of an understanding, I think, that has the power to quite radically change our lives, to allow us to touch the world a little bit more lightly, to hold ourselves a little bit more spaciously, and to liberate other people from our fixed views of who they are or who we believe them to be.